Hello and welcome to Beer Prime episode 66 featuring Tom Mayer from We Are Beer and beer writer David Jesudarson. Thanks for joining me again. Today features two guests. I'll be speaking with Tom Mayer from We Are Beer, organisers of craft beer festivals around the UK. Before I speak with Tom, I'll be playing my interview with beer writer David Jesudarson, who has a new book, Desi Pubs, coming out soon. We met in a local pub to me, which actually is a Desi Pub. I'll also tell you about the incredible Siren Craft Brew 10th anniversary party right after we get a word from our sponsor, White Ribbon UK. White Ribbon is the UK's leading charity engaging men and boys to end violence against women and girls. Many women in the UK craft beer industry are experiencing this violence in many forms, including sexual assault, sexual harassment, sexism and misogyny. It's not their problem to fix, it's the responsibility of us men. Me, you, your friends, your family. Here's White Ribbon trustee Dr. Stephen Burrell.
The fundamental idea is to get men to reflect on the role we can play in trying to prevent violence against women and girls in society from happening in the first place. Recognising that we as men and boys actually have a really positive part to play in challenging that kind of violent and abusive behaviour towards women, which we can see is still far too prevalent in society. But obviously there's lots and lots of men who would never dream of using any kind of violence, and therefore those of us who are totally opposed to this perhaps could and should be doing more to speak out about it. White Ribbon does provide an avenue in which men can do something about it and can play a positive role in being part of the solution.
So if you feel that you want to be part of that solution, head over to the White Ribbon UK website at www.whiteribbon.org.uk and make the White Ribbon promise never to use, excuse, or stay silent about men's violence against women. Maybe even sign up as an ambassador or a champion too. Let's help make the craft beer world a safe place for women. Okay, so as I promised, I said I'd tell you all about the Siren event held on the 18th of March at their taproom site in Finchamstead. Well, the train strike meant that my 1 hour train journey to Wokingham, where Siren were operating a free shuttle bus, looked like it was actually going to be 3 hours each way. So I decided to book in at the Premier Inn in Wokingham, drive there and stay overnight. Much better plan. So when I got to the festival, the site was laid out across the Tapyard taproom, their warehouse, and several marquees, borrowing a little bit of land from their industrial estate neighbours. I headed into the Tapyard, and the first beer I had was one of their birthday beers, Exquisite Corpse, an IPA that they'd put together by approaching 10 people who'd been influential to them over the years, and asked them to propose an element to include in the beer, be it hop, malt, whatever. The only catch? No one knows what each other has proposed. It could have been a massive failure, but it ended up being an incredible beer, hoppy and tropical and very drinkable. Next up, another birthday beer, Times 10, a 100-day aged Helles, which was amazing. I won't list every single beer I had, but we'll mention the likes of Liquid Mistress on cask, the third birthday beer, Crescendo, made in 2022, plus a very special pour, Barrel-Aged Haunted House. If you recall those Fairgrounds trio beers that Siren released a couple of years back, then you'll know what I'm talking about. Plus guest beers, Lord Nelson and Sticky Toffee from Neighbours Elusive Brewing, and a great black IPA from Lakes Brew Co. I bumped into several people that I knew there, including Andy Parker. I was also chatting to Ken, who has taken the plunge and started up a brewery nearby called Mysterious Brewing. Sounds very interesting, and I'm sure that we'll hear more about that venture soon on the podcast. There were some great food trucks there too, I had food from a couple of them, an excellent burger from Original Patty Men, and a gorgeous cheese waffle cone with fried chicken and mac and cheese filling from Killer Waffles. After the party, I headed over to Elusive, where I was privileged enough to have a preview pour of Double Oregon Trail, which was tasting incredible. So thanks very much for that, Andy. If you're listening on the day of release, Elusive have released their Oregon Trilogy today. Oregon Trail, Double Oregon Trail, and Midnight Oregon Trail, which is a Black West Coast IPA. So get your hands on those. Andy then took me back over to the after party, which was excellent. I'm so glad that I got a hotel room. Otherwise, I'd have been on my way home by then and missed a great end to a superb day. Happy 10th to Siren. I will be welcoming Siren's Darren Anley onto the podcast in a couple of months' time to talk with me all about their 10 years. Right then, let's get a guest on. After the shambles recording of the Homebrewers episode, I still feel terrible about that, so apologies to everyone who took part and who listened to the bad quality audio. I was foolish enough to record another live interview in a noisy pub. In fact, this pub was even noisier. However, had a much better microphone with the audio coming out just fine. So last week I headed down to my local Desi pub and met with beer writer David Jesudarson to talk about Desi pubs and his upcoming book on the same subject. Hello, David. How are you doing?
I'm fine, mate. How are you?
I'm good.
Thanks for inviting me.
No problem.
Thanks for the pint of London Pride.
That's okay. So we're in the Crown and Pepper in Caterham, which, as I understand it, is a Desi pub.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's like your most traditional or the best example of a Desi pub, but it's run by some Desis, and they have one in Croydon. We're about to order some food and find out what it's like.
Excellent. Now, for those listening who don't know what a Desi pub is and what Desi means, can you explain that?
Yeah, so where do you start, really, is such a big subject. But to boil it all down is that they're Indian-run pubs. People are from Indian origin. So they don't have to be born in India. They can be like second, third, fourth generation Indians. And they can be people who have come via the Kenya or Uganda. They're part of the Indian diaspora. The word Desi is quite an interesting word because it has a few meanings. The most important meaning is that it's people who are from India. So you wouldn't necessarily call people who live in India a Desi. But it's also this idea of capturing what it was like for the diaspora to leave India. So they have, some Desi pubs have a feel of being part of India in the past. And you can also call a person a Desi, which is quite an acceptable term for a general grouping of people who might be like brown, Indian, Pakistan or something like that.
Okay. And, you're a beer writer, amongst other things, actually, because like doing some research on you, you've written about quite a lot of different subjects, but obviously it's a beer podcast, so we'll start with the beer side of things. You've actually just published a book with Camera Books called Desi Pubs. So is that already out, or is it coming out soon?
It's coming out middle of May. I'm towards the end of writing it. I mean, this is the last pub that actually, funny enough, that I have to visit. And so I've written all the rest. And then we're going to write a 10,000 words introduction to the book, because obviously this is the first time that anyone's ever done anything like this. And it's covering all the different cultural aspects of it. And I've visited a lot of pubs. So I've gone all the way to...
How many would you say?
I mean, so I cover in detail 60 pubs. And then there's like 10 more in slightly less detail. But I have visited over 100 of them. Wow. So it's like 60 of what I think are the best pubs.
Yeah.
And so I've gone from Glasgow to Brighton is the further south. Well, it doesn't seem that far south because we live in the southeast.
Yeah.
But Bristol is another...
I guess from Glasgow is quite a lot south.
Gravesend, Bristol to Glasgow. And then obviously there's a huge concentration of them in North London and the Midlands.
Okay. Excellent. And in reading some of the things that you've written about Desi pubs and on your blog, I find it interesting the history of how Indian and Asian landlords first actually started taking over pubs, because we're going all the way back to when there was the colour bar. So can you tell people about that? It's a very interesting story, I think.
So the first ever Desi pub was in Leicester, and it was called the Durham Ox. And I think that it was 1962, and I think the reason why the guy got the pub licence was because he had a white wife. And that really wasn't, he was a bit of an anomaly, and that's why we got press coverage. And the brewery was very like begrudging to give him the license. They were like, oh yeah, because there's black and Asian customers, we seem to do this. But the general rule of them is in places, particularly in Smethwick and West Brom, the colour bar was rife and there was segregation. So what would happen is there would be, either you'd be banned from the pub, or you'd have to go into the lounge and not be allowed in the assembly or the smoking room. And so there was this guy called After Johal Singh, who was a member of the Indian Workers Association. And what he would do is he'd go into these pubs and get a white comrade, because he was the IWA is a communist organisation, to buy a beer. They would pass the beer to him, and when the landlord or bartender saw this, they would then bar him. And then this was a way of collating evidence to give for when the magistrates licenses came up for renewal. And so when they lost their license, it was often a Desi who would take them over, and that was the first sort of Desi pubs in London. That sort of thing did happen, but also there was this thing called they did give licenses to people of Indian origin, but they had to open clubs, and so they were like membership only, that kind of thing. They're blacked out windows, and those tend to be Gujaratis rather than Punjabis. And so there's this thing of where all the people that I've met are either Gujarati or Punjabi, but the Punjabis were over initially in the 50s and 60s to work in factories and foundries, whether that be in Smethwick or places like West London in Southall near the Southall Hayes near Heathrow Airport. And then there were whole parts of London that were completely racist until the well into the 90s. And so these clubs, like East London particularly, these clubs like the Century Club had to be opened up, and they had to give a safe place to people to come in, express their culture, play bangle music, and then bring in through sizzling platters of shish kebabs and chicken tikka and things like that, which we're about to eat.
Absolutely, yes. So, I mean, would you say that a good Desi pub is somewhere where the food is also of an exceptional quality?
It's an interesting question. That when anyone says, what's a good Desi pub? And my always first answer is the same thing as what a good pub is, and that's community. Often a lot of the landlords, they do a lot of community work. A lot of them tend to be Sikhs. Punjabis are a lot of Punjab, I'll get this right though, because not all Punjabis are Sikhs, but a lot of Punjabis are Sikhs, and they have this thing called Shiva, and that's like community work. And so a lot of them will give away free food. During a pandemic, they gave food away to key workers, and so it fits their persona very well of being community minded. The Gujis, the Gujaratis, also do this, and there's a great pub I went to in Bradford where they did so much community work. They did this thing called Carols and Curry. Despite them being Hindu, they have a carol concert and they give out free curry. They actually allowed the pub to be used as a church on Sundays. They sponsored local football teams. They do all the stuff that you really value in a community pub. But yes, it is also a really good thing that the food is really good. And that's kind of like a modern thing that happened after the smoking ban, because previously Desi pubs were a very male-orientated, wet pub type thing. You might get a bit of food in or all the rest of it, but it really wasn't catering to a wider audience.
It was secondary to the beer.
Exactly, it's like you find a safe place, we'll have some beers, and often what would happen is they'll have a bit of food with it or not. But a lot of people say that the change came in through that, because Indians like to eat while they're drinking, because they've never really been into the curry house culture of having beers and then going off somewhere to eat. They like to do it while they're eating, which is what I like as well. Really.
Well, I mean, it's the sensible way, isn't it, to be honest? About, you know, while you're drinking, have some food.
I mean,
and it stands you in good stead for carrying on rather than just getting absolutely bladdered and going for a curry afterwards. I've never seen the sense in that, to be honest.
I mean, curry houses in this country are a very different thing. They were often run by Bangladeshis or Pakistanis, and they really were so popular because because of the licensing laws catering to the after pub crowd, and they could open till 2 in the morning, and because of that they put up with a lot of racist abuse, that kind of thing. Whereas owning a pub is a much more empowering thing, where you're becoming embedding yourself more in the community. I mean, there are exceptions to that, and restaurants can be community minded, but I think like it really is that unfairness, really, of the way that supermarkets have huge tax discounts compared to pubs, but pubs do all the community work.
Yeah.
It's crazy, right? I was in a Sainsbury's local near me, and the guy stacking the shelves was talking to an old woman, and his manager said, can you stop doing this? You've got to stack the shelves. Whereas that kind of interaction is just a given in a pub, and you would never ever have that interaction, would you?
No, absolutely. It's a good thing to have that. You know, if a customer is feeling welcome and happy with whatever the environment is, pub, supermarket, they're more likely to come back. So it's a bit short-sighted, that. Okay, excellent. So we're looking forward to seeing Desi Pubs out in May. But you've also contributed to another book this year, and that's the Good Beer Yearbook.
Yes, edited by Emma.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's, because that's obviously a collection of pieces, you know, what you recall what's in there? No?
I mean, it's all, I have read it. it's all like really a mishmash of different ideas, and like, so some people are writing about beers. I think I write about the colour bar in that, and I thought it was a very bold commission, as is the book by Camera, is that the Desi Pub book is a bold commission, because as I've known for a while, that Desi Pubs in general, apart from a few very good exceptions, they're not massive on cask or craft for various systemic and various reasons, but I think they're very important, because my favourite Desi pub, one of my favourite Desi pubs, I should say, is the Glad in Borough, and that was originally saved by Camera. And there is a lot of... the other story about Desi pubs is that they save failing pubs.
Yeah.
So they often take over pubs where they were... It's funny, because it was very wet-led, so people, families were put off, that kind of thing. Or it was the opposite, where it was the kind of failing gastro-type pub that made drinkers not feel that welcome.
Yeah.
And the Desi pub caters for everyone, and so that's why it can take over
like a
pub.
Community-led kind
yes.
of...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And when Gaurav and Mega took over the Glad, they did a lot of research to find out why it wasn't working in its present state. And so they kept the best bits, like the pies. They just twisted it so they were like British Indian pies, like chicken tikka pie, you know, mutton paneer pie. And then they kept the music and other things like that. And then we're introducing things like mango and stuff like that.
Right, okay. So going from one of your favourite Desi pubs to something I'll let you elaborate more on, but I read about it on your blog, a pub called the Sam and Nam.
Oh, yes.
So, tell us about that. I thought that was very good.
So, the Sam and Nam is a fictional pub in a Hindi film called Des Pardes. Some people use the term Bollywood, but Bollywood isn't a very good term, because it's a very Western term. You're positioning Hindi films against Hollywood films.
Yeah.
But Des Pardes was a very sort of influential film, because it had this pub, the Sam and Nam, and it's based on a pub in, I think, Rotherhithe, where the guy who directed it and it stars in it, he saw this pub and thought, this is an incredible pub, I want to like base my story in this. And so the pub looks identical, except it's a studio in Bombay.
Right.
And so I got a lot of the historians by showing them the footage of this thing by saying, which pub is this? And they tell me. But what he did is that he read newspaper articles, and he actually features a character that's based on after Jehol Singh that I mentioned, and the Indian Workers Association, isn't it? Right. So it's like a really good time capsule. It was made in 1978, the year I was born, but it's like this time capsule sort of potted history of Desi pubs.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine believes that a lot of Desi pubs in the 80s were based on that look. Which is ironic because that is a traditional pub look.
And it, yeah.
So they copied the way that the barrels are and things like that.
Excellent. So I mentioned earlier that you don't just write about beer. You've got some quite very impressive bylines in the likes of, well, obviously in Beer in Good Beer Hunting, Pellicle, Ferment, Cameralund, Discover, Burham Collective as well, I believe. But then Music Kerrang. Which is interesting.
Yeah, well, that was actually my first ever freelance commissioned article, I think.
Yeah.
Got paid £100 to write about the Japanese metal band Melt Banana.
Yeah. So I'm reading that article, and then I then went and saw a YouTube video on about them.
What did you think?
Just totally unexpected. As soon as she started singing, I did not expect her voice to come out.
She's an amazing power in her voice, isn't it? For such a small woman.
Yeah, exactly. You know? You just would not expect that sound to come out of that lady.
It's interesting. I've not really thought about that article for a while because it's from a fair while ago. But I think what I liked about that was how an Asian person could command a white space. Because we went to like a venue that was just... I think they were supporting someone or whatever, and it just like took over the whole thing, and it's that raw punk vibe.
Yeah,
I felt that lots of people missed out on these movements and everything like that, whereas with Melt Banana and all this, because it was such a cult thing. I think like John Peel, that's why she was popular, because of John Peel. They were popular. Yeah,
absolutely. But also one I'm very, very jealous. A piece for The Guardian where you interviewed Grace Slick about White Rabbit. I mean, one of my favourite songs of all time.
Well, you got to remember that this was in the height of lockdown when I did this. And I did it in... So, like, we had a lot of problems with, like, noise in our house when I was trying to work, which was pretty difficult anyway. And I actually... couldn't really work because my kids, I think then actually we only have one kid. I've got a boy who's two and a daughter who's six. And so what I actually had to do with that interview is I had to interview her in a Wendy house outside in my garden. The thing about Grace that was amazing was that she was actually the more interested in me and the what was happening with our family in lockdown.
Wow.
And how it was, she was really kind of like really empathetic, and I found out a lot about her family life and all these kind of things. And like the interview's like maybe an hour long, and then you've got to crunch it all down to fit the word count on the thing. But
I imagine it's quite a task, really.
Well, the thing is that it is just about that song, which is like. One of those. Is that how I remember the song most from? We're talking about White Rabbit, aren't we? Yeah. The song is that I remember it from is the Simpsons episode where everyone takes drugs.
Oh yeah.
Accidentally, whatever. There's like acid. Yeah. And the hippie. It's the one where Homer becomes a hippie. And I think that song is just when it's played, it always just takes you to. It's the 60s, like that. Yeah. The Doors and the End or whatever. It's like boom. It's the 60s. And so I think like speaking to her, I just kind of felt like I was like. Transported to another world during a very difficult time. Like I was back in the, I was in never in the 60s, but I was there in the 60s hearing about how it all started and everything. And I think really like they're quite a Jefferson Airplane, quite an interesting band because it all just came very quickly and they got her in, kicked someone out, and then the success happened.
And it's amazing to think, obviously, the band evolved in so many different ways over the years. A lot of people will know the band Starship. In the 80s we built this city,
which is very different.
Nothing's going to stop us now. And exactly, that's what I'm saying, that Jefferson Airplane obviously then became Jefferson Starship, and then Starship, all because of kind of legal wrangles with members leaving and not allowing them to take the full name. But yeah, when you look at those songs in the 80s and then you hear White Rabbit, you just can't, you know, when I first heard White Rabbit, as I say, one of my favourite songs now, when I first heard it, I was shocked that it was the same, essentially, most of the same band, certainly the same singer.
What's great about White Rabbit is its message, really.
Yeah.
Strip away all that stuff. It's not really about drugs. People say it's about taking acid, but it's about reading books, and it's about opening your mind up to new things. And I think that's a universal thing that you could, I played it to my six-year-old daughter, and I think she was quite surprised by how stark the song is.
Yes.
Sort of vocally very, desperate from the instruments, although the guitar ship is really, really good on it.
It
is a phenomenal song, and although you see it in adverts and everything like that, it's pretty ubiquitous for a song that's now 65 years.
Incredible.
Crazy, isn't
absolutely
it?
Incredible.
It's absolutely crazy. It's so old, that song. It's really refreshing, and it's one of the ones that no matter how many times you hear it, if you catch yourself at the right moment, your hairs on the back of your neck will stand up.
Yeah.
I love that feeling that music can totally exhilarate you.
No, absolutely. And timeless, just a timeless song. So if anybody hasn't heard that song, go and listen to it on wherever, YouTube, whatever. White Rabbit, Jefferson Airplane. Some people would have heard it and not know what we're talking about.
Right.
Until they start playing it.
Play a bit in this and break the.
I could.
Because if there's any problems, we could just rig Grace up and
get permission.
Yeah.
Well, I'm all for that. Right, well, the food has arrived.
Help yourself. I've
forgotten anyway,
And give me notes of what you think to it.
Yeah, let's stick this back over here. Still recording. So what's this one?
Szechuan Mogo. Mogo's cassava.
Yeah.
It can be cut like chips, or we're having it in cubes. And I've never had a Szechuan sauce, because this is a rare pub that does Chinese as well as Indian. Whereas you get a lot of classic dishes which are Indo-Chinese, like chili chicken.
Mm.
Whereas this is, I guess this would say it's very Indo-Chinese. It's very nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a kick, isn't it? I can see you're going red.
There is a bit of a kick. I don't mind spice. I'm
I should get you another beer, shouldn't I?
I'm happy with spicy foods. But I'm on the scale of being a little bit of a kick. If I go to Nando's, for example, I'm the kind of the mid-range spice.
Yeah. But I've got to correct you, when you say spicy, you mean chili heat, don't you?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Because
not all spices are...
A mulled wine. Mulled wine is spicy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
true. But you don't go, oh my God, I need some water with this, do you?
No, fair point. I suppose it's just a word that we tend to sort of use for...
It's really interesting, because my mum used to do that. And in fact, I think with a lot of the copy I've written at the start, I was making it's easy to lapse into, because people, even the landlords, will say, well, this is quite spicy.
Yeah.
But what they mean is heat.
Yeah.
Can people tolerate spice? My kids, they could tolerate spice. So I'll make a curry, but I won't put any chilies in.
Right.
And they can't tolerate necessarily the heat. And they like the spices, because some spices bring out sweetness and that kind of thing. Coriander and all that, But. So, a typical, if you want to know, you see the word desi a lot in menus. So, a desi chicken curry is this cooked Diaba style.
Okay.
Which is where you caramelize the onions, put loads of garlic and chili in, and then slow cook the meat. And that's how my mum used to cook curries. And so, it was quite it can be quite moving and nostalgic to eat a lot of this food. Because it is very similar. It's not home cooking. Because when you get a curry in a restaurant or a desi pub, it's never thin sauce, which is what you will get when you cook it yourself.
Yeah.
it's commercial cooking, so it is thicker, but it can be very similar to the things that I've only experienced by my mother cooking.
Yeah.
Like chicken tikka she would make, and tandoori chicken. Now, these aren't exactly, I want to use this horrible word, authentic foods, but they are foods that she would do to recreate what's being done in restaurants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so we get them here. But that word authentic is perhaps a bit problematic as well, because chilies weren't introduced in India until the 16th century.
Really?
Tomatoes and potatoes until maybe centuries later. Mm. So if you're going to talk about authentic food, what are you going to eat? I mean, I've got friends who are Jain and they don't eat anything that's grown under the ground. So they will have curries that don't have onions or garlic or ginger, you know, or potatoes or things like that. And so they're trying to recreate things like that. That a lot of them went to Africa, actually, and then that's where it totally went out the window because food was scarce and everything like that. So it's this thing, and that's a very Desi thing of trying to recreate things from the past. And the thing that's interesting about Desiness is that in India, they're not looking to the past, they're looking to the West. So like my mate who from India, who runs craft brewery, White Rhino, Ishan, he will come to these Desi pubs with me and he'll be like, he wouldn't be derogatory about it, but he finds it funny that a lot of these pubs are based in a very traditional Punjabi rural background type of way.
Yeah.
And for him, he's like, well, in India, we don't have these foods, but apparently you do get a mixed grill in India.
Okay.
But it's like stuffed peppers and different meats, and it's not done in a tandoor. It's done on a tala, which is a large pan. It's like an Indian style wok.
Yeah.
And they will call curries that we have here British style curries.
Yeah. Right. Okay. You want to dig into the
so
the
we
food
have
then?
The chicken tikka.
Yeah. Have a little bit there.
So these would have come on cooked on skewers, but they come out in pieces.
Just grab this piece here.
And then have some of the...
Oh, yeah.
We've only been given one sauce here, which is the mint sauce here. That's very good, isn't it? Mm. Oh.
I
think with food, it's very... People often ask, where's the best mixed grill or whatever? And I think, like, food is, like... varies so much on your mood and whatever you're doing, so it's quite hard to answer that question. But this is very good food, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very good.
What are the other pubs like for food around there?
We don't really go to pubs for food around here, to be honest. We sort of tend to go to ones out in the country instead. So, yeah. Right, so I just wanted to quickly mention, like, touch on a couple of things. So, obviously, we've talked about you being a beer writer, but of course, you're not just any beer writer, you're an award-winning beer writer as well. You won a couple of awards at the British Guild of Beer Writers Awards in November, December last year. And you also was Writer of the Year at the BIH Spotlight Awards. Perhaps not just for beer, in that one. So that's some great accolades. You're a director on the British Guild of Beer Writers as well. But the one thing I really want to sort of touch on and perhaps end on is when I was doing a little bit of research, I discovered that you used to be a stand-up comedian.
Yes.
How did that go?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it for like five years, and as a writer, it's the most immediate form of the art form, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Because you'd write some material and then learn it.
Deliver it.
And then deliver it.
Yeah.
I used to quite like ad-libbing as well, like hosting and emceeing, but it just became unplayable when I had kids.
Yeah,
and if you think writing's difficult because of the fees and everything like that, then it's even worse for comedians. So yeah, I have a lot of... I think the one thing about comedy that's really good, and it's interesting because I obviously still follow a lot of my friends that I did comedy with on Twitter, is that it is one place where you can talk about race and discuss it in a sort of very rough and raw way. Mm. And that's something that's becoming encroaching on, where people are saying that you can't say these things and all this kind of thing. And I do think that, like, and when you do see clips out of context, it's very difficult. And I don't want to be drawn into this. I hate the idea of cancel culture because I don't really think it exists.
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, when people film clips of comedians working through material, it is a bit harsh to judge them on what they're saying, because they're trying to. It's just the one thing where you try and find out immediately, can you say this? Can you do this?
Yeah.
And I do think that there should be a sort of very much of a free speech element in this. But obviously, hate speech and anything that's like, yeah, should definitely not be done. But I do think that it operates in a different sphere to what I do in journalism and stuff, yeah, like that.
Fantastic. Well, okay, we will finish off this food, get dug in. But I just wanted to say thank you, David, for joining me.
And absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Good luck on the with the book with Desi Bubbs. I'm sure it's going to be a great success.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you.
That was great. Hope you enjoyed that. Keep your eyes open for David's book coming in May. Now let's welcome Tom Mayer from We Are Beer. Hello, Tom.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem at all. We're both cracking open a beer to start off. It's been a long week already for me, actually, so I don't mind admitting. So I know you've cracked one open. So whilst I pour mine, which is a Burning Sky Petit Saison, can you tell me about the beer that you're drinking?
Yeah, so it's a brewery fairly new, since 2019, called Basement Beer, based in Bristol. So the beer is called Trespassers Will Be Lasered. It's a sensual pale ale, is what they call it, 4.5%. So this guy has very kindly sent some beers to the office. So we tried some earlier and I thought, yep, I need another one of these.
Excellent. Okay, fantastic. So if people haven't heard of We Are Beer before, explain what it is you do.
Yeah, so We Are Beer is a company that runs craft beer festivals across the UK. So this year it'd be Bristol Craft Beer Festival, Manchester Craft Beer Festival, and London Craft Beer Festival. Mm-hmm. London was the first festival that launched in 2013. So it'd be its 11th festival this
year. Okay. It's always difficult, isn't it, with the COVID years, to actually work out how many there were.
Yeah, it's like how many years minus the COVID year. Although for Bristol, we actually did run a festival in 2020, just in the window between the lockdowns. And it was like a whole COVID safe festival. Everyone would tell you how weird an experience it was, but it was also great just to be able to have some normality in that situation as well.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. So London was first, and that was, as you say, back in 2013. How did it all get started? What's the story behind it all?
So it's two uni friends, so Greg Wells and Dan Sylvester. They both met at uni in Leeds. Eventually both had moved to London. Dan at the time was running a venue, Oval Space, which is where the first London Craft Beer Festival was held. Greg at the time was working for a marketing agency that specialized in drinks. So both of them had kind of obviously Oval Space being in East London, so obviously a lot of craft beer kind of emerging from there. Greg working within drinks industry, so obviously could saw this emergence in craft beer. And basically they both thought, well, we've got this venue, we both love craft beer, why don't we start a kind of modern beer festival as a kind of passion project? So that's how it started. It was a very small event. I think it was something like 2,000 people, about 20 breweries. But it's when you look at the list of some of the breweries that were there and who was pouring as well. You had Logan from Beavertown was pouring.
Okay.
Evan from The Colonel, Jasper from Camden, and Mikel from Mikella as well. So, okay, you know, you've got these massive names now, which at the time these breweries were all very new, and you know, Logan was still brewing in the basement of a pub, and you know, obviously Mikel coming over, it's quite a big deal even then. But you look back now, and it's a crazy lineup.
That's amazing. Obviously, there's a, because you know, I guess a lot of people listening have been to a, well, I hope they have anyway, been to a beer festival before. Now, the majority of beer festivals, you pay your entry fee, gives you a free glass, maybe a few tokens. You guys have got a completely different model, which is the all beer included model.
Yeah, so you put it correctly. All your beer is included in the ticket. So essentially, what it does, it takes out that kind of transactional mindset that you go into with some beer festivals. So, you know, you might get your tokens and then you're kind of going around, and often enough, you're either looking at what's kind of like the highest ABV beer I can get with the least amount of tokens, or, you know, you've got that risk of like, that beer sounds nice, but do I want to spend my tokens on it? You know, have the risk. With the, what happens with this, all, you know, all your beer included, you take all that away and suddenly, you know, let's say you don't normally like sours. Well, suddenly you can go and try a sour, and if you don't like it, you can pour it away. There's nothing stopping you. And if there's a beer that you like the look of, you can like go up and try it and go back and try it again and again. So it's really about that. It's all about discovery, really. So, you know, I think some people have this illusion that everyone's just gonna go there and get really drunk, and we don't find that at all. We find that people are there to just to discover all these different beers. So yeah, taking away that transactional frame of mind really just opens up people to discovering new things. I mean, me myself, the first year I went to London Craft Beer Festival, I didn't like sours, so you know, I was trying everything. I was like, oh, there's a sour there, I'm not sure if I want to try it. And I was like, well, what's the harm, what's the risk?
Yeah, sure.
And then I'm pretty sure I went around finding all the other sours that are at that festival. So, you know, it shows it does work. It kind of allows you to be a bit more open-minded and try new things without any risk.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, obviously, I'm sure the prices have changed throughout the years, but for this year's festivals, what are the prices?
So Bristol and Manchester are £55 plus booking fee. London slightly more at £57.50 plus booking fee.
Okay, but in so, that you're getting entertainment in that as well.
Yes, yeah, and then there's access to our food markets as well. Which I mean, to call it a food market, I mean there's some like top restaurants that come along to the festivals. So it's not kind of like your just standard burger or hot dog. There's like actual restaurants that have come and done like a kind of pop-up version of their restaurants. So it's always great because it shows what festivals can be, kind of that slightly elevated, you know, and understanding that people want more than that at beer festivals for food and sustenance as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, fantastic. So let's go through this year's offering. I believe you start with Bristol on the 9th to 10th of June.
That's right.
Then on to Manchester, 21st to 22nd of July, and London, 11th to 12th of August. When do tickets go on sale?
So all the tickets are on sale. So, yep, they're available now.
Okay.
We've recently launched some group offers as well. So if you've got four of you, you'll get a discount there as well.
Right. Okay. Excellent. And I've noticed that that you have done in the past other cities, that there was a Edinburgh in the past.
Yeah.
And I think it looked like you were due to have a Glasgow one this year. So what's the story
yeah,
there?
Yeah, so originally we had Edinburgh in the mix. Unfortunately, the venue we were using, we just outgrew it. So we're looking for another venue in Edinburgh. We'd found one, kind of temporarily found a venue there, and then that venue got sold, so we had to then look for somewhere else. So we actually moved last year. We moved the festival to Glasgow. Right. We had a great venue there, SWG3. It's kind of similar to like an old warehouse that we, you know, it's quite a We Are Beer venue, we'd say. Yeah, we had Beer Central in Birmingham as well. I think what's just happened is we've had, you know, some really tough years. I mean, we've not had a normal year probably since 2019.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've felt the pinch as everyone does. You know, the suppliers for everything that we'd get for the festivals has all gone up. We're a very small team. I don't think people realize there's 8 of us in the team.
Okay.
So there was 8 of us running those 5 festivals.
Mm.
So what we've had to do is just kind of take a step back this year and concentrate on some of the more established festivals. And what it's really about is what one of our key goals, for example, is with London, and why not make it the biggest beer festival in Europe? You know, that's kind of our goal. We've never really had the chance to do it because we've spread ourselves so thinly with other festivals. This year, we're definitely going big with London and trying to really establish that. And then, yes, you know, hopefully we can bring Glasgow back and Beer Central back. It's just, yeah, at the moment, a bit of timing, a bit of how small our team is and just costs.
Okay. So, I mean, I was going to ask about, you know, even more cities, the likes of Leeds, Sheffield, Brighton. It sounds like they may be, you know, if you consider them, they may be a little way off yet while you build yourselves back up after, as you say, the
yeah, COVID definitely. Years. Yeah. You know, we're always speaking about new places, and, you know, it's also making sure we're not stepping on too many toes as well. You know, I know with Manchester, you know, there are some festivals. Obviously, yeah, there's Indie Man, and Cloudwater had their festival, which, you know, I haven't seen that run for a while. So, you know, even with Indie Man, we made sure that we operate nowhere near that. You know, we're in July, they're in October. So, and then, you know, Leeds is already a great beer city as well, that, you know, there could be some options there. But yeah, it's really kind of making sure we're picking places that have a great beer scene and a great audience for it as well.
Mm.
Which is, you know, that's why we picked Edinburgh and then moved to Glasgow, because the Scottish beer scene was great. And, you know, Birmingham is really emerging. It's, you know, the last few years, some amazing breweries that have come out of there.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you know, these are all summer month festivals. I did notice that you had a Christmas one in London last year. Is that something that you're going to look to continue running?
Yeah, we're definitely going to have a look at it. It was very tough last year. We had the festival over a weekend of the strikes, which, you know, we fully support. It was just a very tough time. It meant not a lot of people could actually attend the festival. It's also really funny how this year we probably had the London Craft Beer Festival. The summer edition was on the hottest day of the year.
Okay.
And then for the Christmas one, it was the complete opposite. It was freezing. So it was just so funny to have to kind of like experience both of those kind of extremes. Yeah, never say never. You know, as I said, even with Glasgow and Beer Central, you know, we're just looking at what we want to make sure that we can put on great festivals. So we don't want to spread ourselves too thinly and try and bring new things in, or, you know, or try to make some of them bigger when we know that there's not quite the appetite for it. You know, there's the cost of living crisis and, you know, people's energy bills spiking, which means, you know, people's disposable income is a lot less. So we understand there's a lot of competition there of where people are going to be spending their money.
Yeah.
You know, even with, you know, holidays and other festivals. So yeah, I think this year it's just really kind of concentrating on some of the core festivals. And, you know, Manchester's very new. Manchester was only launched in 2021.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just about those established festivals and Manchester hopefully growing. And, you know, what we'd love is that Manchester becomes kind of like our version of London Craft Beer Festival for the North, like that kind of size, really build it up.
Mm. Mm. Okay, so, I mean, we were talking earlier when you mentioned the first one, the very first London Craft Beer Festival, 20 breweries. How many can we expect now? I don't know. I mean, how does it work? Are we looking at it being generally the core of the same breweries, or does it differ from festival to festival?
Yeah, it differs from festival to festival, just depending on the kind of size of the venues. Bristol, we've got a great venue, Harbourside. It's called Lloyd's Amphitheatre. Mm. So it's right along the water. we are limited to how many breweries we can have there because of the space we have. You know, we could look at other venues, but it's just such a great spot, and it has been ever since we moved there. So I think we'd find it very hard to move from there. So yeah, Bristol has anything up to about 40 to 45 breweries.
Okay.
Then Manchester has around 50 to 55. Then London, it's Tobacco Dock, so we have ample space. And I think one of the reasons we moved there is that as the festival grows, we can take on more space. So I think last year, at last count, we had 130 breweries.
Wow, okay.
So there'll definitely be 100 plus breweries this year. It's just, yeah, it's crazy when you think of it. But if you've ever been to the venue, it never quite feels like it's that many because there's so many kind of nooks and crannies in all different rooms.
Yeah.
But when you actually add it all up, it's a massive affair.
No, it sounds incredibly large, yeah. I mean, you know, are we talking the focus on local? So would Bristol, for example, have a lot of more local breweries, same with Manchester, or is it just depends on who signs up for each festival?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the core is definitely we look at the local breweries first. I mean, Bristol, very much specifically, you know, Bristol love supporting local. They love their breweries. So we always find it funny, like, you know, you could bring some breweries from across the US to Bristol, but the first breweries that will sell out will be Bristol breweries because their mind is like they're supporting those guys, even though the beer is free and you can obviously try any of the breweries. it's always still some of the first beer to go. And same with Manchester, you know, we concentrate on the local breweries. London is obviously, there's an array of London breweries, and obviously we've got a choice of 100 plus breweries spaces to fill there. So it's a lot broader. But yeah, you know, I think pre-COVID, it was very easy to get European, and pre-Brexit, I should say, it's very easy to get European and American breweries to come along.
Yeah.
Now it's a lot harder. You know, you kind of have to find ways of getting them over. But I mean, luckily the experience doesn't change because, you know, that kind of all-in model that we have and that discovery and experience. And, you know, we're lucky that there are still new breweries that are popping up. You know, Basement here as an example, you know, 2019, they're still very young. So, you know, it's great that we get to have some of the more established breweries that come along. You know, Siren, for example, you know, celebrating their 10th birthday. They were there at the at the first LCBF as well. And, you know, likes of Thornbridge that come along as well, the Colonel. So there's still those really well-established and well-loved breweries. And then for us, it's just, we kind of have like we have a list of people that we would love to come. And then it's just all about logistics, you know, whether people can or not. And that is seemingly getting harder and harder.
Yeah, I can imagine. You mentioned there your list of potential breweries, ones that haven't come. So forgetting the list as it might be a collaborative effort amongst the 8 members of the team, just you. What is your dream participant that you've never managed to attract yet that you would absolutely love to come over to the... Obviously, it would be next year. You've already organised this year's ones. So who would that be?
Oh, that is a tough one. I mean, I feel like just for kind of like the hype around the beer, it'd probably be someone like Russian River. I still have never had Pliny the Elder. Okay. So,
yeah, me too. Know. Me too. It's one of those things, isn't it? So... gutting. It's not as if it's so readily available.
Yeah,
but you know, those people that have had it gloat about having had it, and it's just killing me.
I know there's channels, you know, of getting it as well. You know, you can speak to people in the US to kind of get it sent over, and you know, I know there's a lot of like swaps that happen and things like that. I think for me though, it'd be great to have them, you know, the beer come over and have it poured. You know, I think that would be such a great experience. Failing that, I think someone like Cantillon.
Okay.
I mean, you know, that I remember when I first kind of got into craft beer, me and one of my friends just decided to do a trip over to Belgium. We kind of went to Bruges, and then on the way back just so happened to hear about Cantillon and spent an afternoon there and just like blown away by the beers. I think Nath, the rhubarb beer is still one of my favorite beers. I mean, you know, you need a pack of Rennies when you go there and try the beers, but it's such an experience. And you know, there's no reason as such as why you couldn't come. And obviously there's probably more like pricing and just, you know, volume as well. You know, as we said, like with London, we could have up to 16,000 people this year. That's a lot of beer to bring. Yeah. So if, I think there's some breweries that we probably would love to have. It's just the volume as well. That's an issue.
Yeah. So is there a criteria for when you're looking to put the festival together and you're, I mean, I don't know how it works. Do you invite them? Do you perhaps invite requests to attend? How does it work? And besides how it works, so explain to me how it works first. But then, is there a particular criteria for if a brewery were to come to you and ask to be involved, but for some reason, I'm not even going to speculate, they didn't meet the criteria? How would that go?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's a very simple criteria is that we have to try the beer first. There's no brewery that comes that we haven't tried their beer first. That is the top kind of criteria for us. You know, if it's beer that we don't enjoy as a team, we won't have them along. And you know, we're a bit more split now. We have a set of spaces that we invite breweries to, and then there is room for breweries that want to do bigger activations. So for example, in London, there's all these different little rooms in Tobacco Dock. We call them the vaults. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if a brewery wants to come and do something like that, then, you know, we have spots open for that. In Manchester, we have these arches as well. And Bristol, there's space for kind of activations as well. So it's a bit of a mix, but mainly it's invited breweries. And yeah, we have to try the beer first and it has to be good. Otherwise, it's just a straight no. You know, it's always surprising to us how, you know, it's our first impression of some breweries, and you know, on occasion some of the beers are kind of like almost out of date and aren't fresh, and you know, it's hard because obviously you're having to give feedback to these people as well. But, you know, I guess this could help move along to the Razor Bar competition that we run.
Yes, tell me about that.
Yeah, so if you're originally, if you were a brewery that was 3 years or brewing commercially 3 years or less, you'd be able to enter the competition. At the moment, we've actually extended it to 5 years just because we realized the COVID years probably kind of shortened that list by quite a lot. So essentially, people send in their beer. Then we have a team of judges who will judge the beer. So currently confirmed for that is Johnny Garrett from the Craft Beer Channel. Mm-hmm. Jacob Wise from Wildcard. Mm-hmm. We have Joanne Love, who works for Bathhouse and does Love Beer Learning. So you know, we've got an array of kind of well-known people within craft beer who are there to judge. Oh, and sorry, I should also mention Jen Merrick as well, who now works at Big Smoke. She's been a judge on Razor Bar from the start. Mm-hmm. So she's been great, and obviously, you know, famed from Beavertown back in the day. Mm-hmm. So you have these amazing judges that try the beer, and then four winners are picked from that, and those four winners get to come to each of our craft beer festivals. So essentially, you know, get to show off their beers to the attendees.
Okay, fantastic. And what kind of previous winners have you had?
So we've had likes of Burnt Mill, Attic, Pastore. So there's been like a real mix of kind of different styles there. Mm. Obviously like Pastore with their amazing sours.
Yeah.
Attic makes they make an array of different beers as well. Same with Burnt Mill, to be honest. And we've had other breweries like Dig Brew, who sadly obviously no longer here. But, you know, it's been great. To see all these kind of new young breweries and the kind of surprise that we have as well. I mean, one great example as well is Turning Point. They, when they first entered Razor Bar, none of the judges had ever seen them before. And we tried their beers and they were amazing. And now you know, Turning Point join us for all the festivals. They have big activations at the festival. So it's great to see, you know, there was a brewery there that they'd won Raise the Bar, and they've kind of built on that success. So it's yeah, it's always interesting to see the progression of some of those breweries.
Excellent. Okay. So if anybody is listening and runs a brewery that fits in with that, you know, not been brewing for longer than 5 years, when do entries close?
So that will be on the 12th of April.
Okay.
It's razorbar.wearebeer.com.
Yep. Perfect. Excellent. Okay. Well, you never know. There may be somebody listening that decides to go into that. Okay. Fantastic. Now, let's talk about the safety of women at festivals. What are you doing to ensure that everybody, not just women as well, obviously, you know, the safety for women, but also that the inclusion of everybody at the festivals, how are you handling that?
Yeah, so I think when the Everyone Welcome initiative was first launched, we absolutely jumped at the chance to have that and put it all over the festival. I think that was with Melissa Cole, who'd help mm-hmm. initiate that. Lily Waite was working with us at the time. So it was great to kind of, you know, big advocates of just having that absolutely everywhere when that first started. Then obviously, you know, around COVID, we had that kind of that Me Too moment in beer where there was, you know, a lot of stories coming out.
Mm.
And it was a big shock, you know, for a lot of us. Well, for a lot of men, I'd say. I think a lot of women, you know, this was just kind of the everyday that this was happening to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a personal point of view, it really did open my eyes. And, you know, it's why last year I kind of tried to make sure that, one thing I put forward is that we created a Brave Noise beer that was the festival beer for all our festivals.
Right.
And we were very lucky. We got to work with the Brave Noise team. They came over to the London Craft Beer Festival as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I worked very closely with Ash and Ren, who came over, and Helen from the Burham Collective was kind of like, I guess, a bit of an advocate in the UK, made appearance there as well. So it was great to make people aware of what was happening. And, you know, from that, we'd already had our code of conduct, which we share with the breweries.
Mm-hmm.
So this time it was obviously just making sure that our attendees were aware of that. So we had that on, I think it was all the toilets. We had all posters up. We had asked for Angela signs as well.
Mm.
So, you know, it's very important to us. You know, I'd obviously heard no stories from our festivals, but stories from festivals where people had, you know, there was incidents. So for me, it was very important that doesn't happen at our festivals. You know, we're lucky that we've never had reports of anything necessarily happen at our festivals.
Mm.
But, you know, that's not the point. I think the point was to make sure that there's a way that if anything does happen, that people can report it. So, you know, last year was great to have the Brave Noise team over. You know, I got to learn a lot from them as well about safety of women, and you know, it was, I think for a lot of people as well, just having been involved with them showed that we cared about that as well. Mm. It wasn't that we were just trying to kind of tick boxes. For me, it was very important that we got them involved, and, you know, having that Brave Noise beer as the festival beer was great. It was a great way for us to help raise awareness for it as well across the UK.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, a lot of other festivals are involving people from the Coven and the likes of those yep. organisations to kind of patrol the festival. Is that something that you would look at?
Well, it's something we've kind of already had in place with the security teams that we work with.
Okay.
I mean, especially last year, that was one of the criteria, and one of the briefs was for people to, well, for everyone to be aware that members of the public could come up to you and ask for Angela, or, mm. you know, say that something had happened, and that we would work based on that. And all the security staff had the numbers of us, the organisers, so they could get in contact with us. So we'd already kind of had this in place with our security. I mean, last year we kind of obviously amped it up with the help of the Brave Noise team. You know, we understood a lot more of what was expected. We also work with security teams that have female security staff members as well.
Yeah,
you know, often the case can be that you have these, you know, massive men that are standing there, and if something's just happened to you, you don't necessarily want to go up to someone like that, or it might feel intimidating, because obviously that's kind of the point of security to an extent.
That's actually exactly what I thought as well, is that sometimes just having the standard security doesn't necessarily have the effect that you would think. So having, as you say, female security as well, obviously is a great help.
Yeah, and you know, we have a front of house. It's very obvious that, you know, it's a team member that's always there, or someone representing. We have volunteers as well, and they're all briefed as well that someone might come up to you, because obviously, last year they were wearing these really bright tie-dye t-shirts. It was very obvious that they were volunteering at the festival. So, you know, it's just making people aware that if something happened and someone came up to you, that here's what we need to do in that process.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So you mentioned the Brave Noise beer, and I do see that you've done some other collaborations on beers with some brewers. Have they been solely for the purpose of brewing a collaboration and serving at the festival?
It's a bit of, you know, obviously there's a part where it's great if the beer can come out beforehand and, you know, kind of help market the festival a bit more. But essentially, yeah, generally speaking, the beers are often special for the festival, a special pour. And partly, you know, it's also trying to work with certain breweries. You know, we also I mentioned Lilyway earlier. You know, we had for London, Preferred Pronouns, which was a collaboration between Queer Brewing, Brick Brewery, and ourselves. That was our festival beer, and you know, there was money that went to charity there. So you know, there's times where we kind of try and mix up where, if we can, we can link in a good cause there. Otherwise, you know, often enough, it is creating a beer with some of our friends. You know, I think Wiper and True are probably one of the breweries that we've made the most beers with, because we've worked with them since day one.
Yeah.
And we've made some amazing beers with them. We made one with Fozia, who runs Arawella Eats. She's a Somalian. And we created this amazing cardamom beer, which it sounds weird, but once you try it, it was just really great. And we had a great day of experimenting with the flavors and kind of trying it with cardamom and tea and seeing what kind of came out with it. So, you know, there's still part of kind of experimenting in that and just, you know, working with different people and creating different experiences really through the beer.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I'm going to open another beer. I'm going to go on to Verdant's This Is Memorial Device, which is a West Coast IPA. So, you know, I know that they do brew them, but given that their output on IPAs is generally the hazy stuff, I'm looking forward to giving this a go. Nice. Have you, I assume Verdant are a regular attendee?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's hard not to have one of the, you know, best IPA producers in the UK along. I mean, it, you know, you could say the world, to be honest, as well. You know, I think there was a time when, you know, we had this massive hype about US beers, you know, those juicy beers. And, you know, you have the likes of Verdant and Daya in the UK now that are creating beers that match those, if not, you know, are even better than those guys. I always find it weird. I used to work in a bottle shop before, and you know, the price on some of the American beers, which were just basically a Verdant or a Daya kind of beer. You know, I get it. You know, it's all about experiencing the beers and kind of, you know, you want to tick them off as well.
Yeah.
For me, it just got to a point where Steady Rolling Man, for example, is like a standard beer for me. And Lightbulb from Verdant, you know, they're very hard to beat. If I see them on the tap, it's very likely that I'll be going for those beers.
Yeah, no, they're great beers. So I'm going to ask you now, it's the impossible question. So I can promise you, I am not expecting all of the names, but Can we get an idea of what kind of, you know, what breweries are going to be attending your festivals this year?
Yes. So for London, we've got one that we're excited about is Seven Island from Greece. They're coming over, so we're having them over the first time. Mm. Flock are coming to the festival for the first time as well at London. One that I'm always really excited about is the American Brewers Association. So generally speaking, we have 20 plus US breweries that come over. The beauty is we never really know until a lot later down the line of who that is.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're always great brewery. We had Cigar City and just a range of different breweries that are just amazing and new ones as well, ones that we've never tried. So it is great, you know, if you are looking to kind of tick some new beers off, that's always great. Then, you know, for Bristol, for example, we've got Duggars from Sweden. Mm. We've got Glasshouse from Birmingham coming over. And Duvel as well will be at Bristol. And, you know, some that are coming to Manchester, you know, some local favourites like Track and Sure Shot will be coming to the festival for the first time. And then we have the rescued Kelham Island as well.
Okay.
Will be at the festival. Yeah. Mm. Which I'm very excited. I've still not managed to try. I know there was some events in London. I still haven't managed to try the beer, but I'm excited to see them.
Excellent. And I guess, are they all confirmed breweries listed on the website?
Yes. Yeah. So our first announcement was earlier this month. So yeah, I mean, probably about 50-60% of the breweries. So we, we hold some back, and obviously there's some that we're still trying to get across the line. You know, as I said, those special ones that we try to get, there's still a lot of those to confirm.
Okay, so the idea basically is that, you know, there's going to be some great beer, so just go and buy a ticket.
Yeah.
And then keep your eye on the brewery. So don't keep your eye on waiting for your favorite brewery to come up.
Well, the funny thing is, buy it
and then look at it as well, because it's going to be great beer anyway, so just buy your ticket.
Exactly. It's always funny, actually, because even with myself, even when we have, like, you know, a hyped brewery or someone who's never come over before, I still end up drinking the Colonel or Keller Pils from Lost and Grounded.
Yeah, yeah.
There's beers that are just Brick Brewery, you know, their sours in the sun are just amazing. So there's some breweries that you can't help but go back to. And, you know, I've been with the company for 5 years now, and, you know, you just make friends with everyone. It's like seeing your family again, kind of like Christmas time when the first festival hits.
Yeah.
So more or less it's going around and just saying hello to everyone again and hanging around with them. So a lot of the time I don't actually have the chance to try some of those other beers because I'm too busy kind of catching up with everyone. But yeah, we do have, you know, say with London, there's 100 plus breweries that, you know, even I won't get to try them all, and I'll be at the festival weekend. So
yeah,
there's a lot to get through.
No, exactly. I would imagine that 100 plus is going to be some going for anybody. You'd have to make sure you went for the entire weekend, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. On your website, I saw something that looked quite intriguing. You're beginning a journey into content, telling the great many stories around beer. So what's that about?
Yeah, we've kind of just like to realize that, you know, we have all these festivals, we work with all these great breweries, and, you know, we work with great drinks producers as well that come along to festival beyond beer. And for us, it's you know, we're all about champion beer. So we are now looking at how we can kind of put the breweries into the spotlight a bit more and, you know, get people to learn a lot more about beer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of people see the festival and assume, like, you know, the majority are beer geeks that come along, but, you know, we have a lot of people that, you know, they love beer, but they might know a few names. They might know, for example, Beavertown or Brewdog, but they might not know some of like the niches. So it's really a way of us to kind of extend people's knowledge base and, you know, talk about the different styles of beer a bit more. And I guess not be too snobby about the festival and, like, you know, assuming that everyone knows everything as well. So for us, it's really just about championing the the breweries and the beer culture in general. So that's something that we're really going to be trying to push moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's quite important, isn't it? Because, you know, you like what you like, and it's not, you know, it's not really, to me anyway, it's not really a done thing to ridicule people for only liking a certain type of beer, a few breweries. Yes, you know, it's great for them to broaden their horizons. And, you know, attending a festival like yours with so many different breweries gives them that opportunity, even if their comfort zone is only something, as you say, like a Beavertown or Brewdog or something like that. Hopefully this will get them into an understanding what is out there and knowing that there is just so much more to discover.
Yeah. And yeah, we have to remember as well that we all had a first brewery, right? Or the first brewery that kind of got us into craft beer.
Yeah. What was yours? You know,
I mean, it probably was Brewdog. I wouldn't be too shocked if that was the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was also London Fields Brewery back in the day when I first kind of moved back to London after uni. I think it was Hackney Hopster. I'm kind of from Hackney originally. So I think I saw that and thought, oh, yeah, I'll give that a go. You know, I was drinking kind of real ales and stuff at uni. We used to go to a pub quiz every Tuesday and just try whatever cask was on at the time. So it definitely started from cask. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people nowadays where, you know, neck oil will be someone's first craft beer.
Yeah.
So it's understanding that that is people's journey now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why, you know, we'd never say never to having the likes of, you know, Beavertown or Camden, where we know that that is the first step for some people. And I think what a lot of breweries would probably understand is that if we had Beavertown, for example, on the list, that someone would be like, oh, Beavertown are there. That means it's a great festival. Not really understanding any of the politics or anything that goes along with it. But
yeah, I mean, to a lot of people, that would be the opposite, maybe.
Yeah, say, exactly.
What the hell are Beavertown doing there?
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, there's people that they've just started their craft beer journey and they see Beavertown everywhere. The same way we did when it first launched. You know, you see the designs, you see the cans, and you're drawn to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's weird when you kind of twist it around the other way and see it from a different viewpoint. You understand that having someone like that could actually elevate the event and get someone along who might not have then tried all the other breweries. So, you know, it's for us, it's just as important to make sure, obviously, that the beer geeks are all happy, but to make sure that anyone who's new to craft beer feels like it's accessible and that we can make it enjoyable for them.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So let's go away from the festivals a little bit and just talk about yourself and your beer journey and your beers. What are your favorites? Forget the festivals, forget who's pouring at a particular festival. What's your favorite go-to beers?
I mean, really is the Colonel Table beer.
Okay. Yeah.
It for me, that's very hard to beat because there's never an occasion where that beer doesn't work. Maybe if it's a really hard day and you need a higher ABV, then obviously that's not going to be the one that gets you there. But for me, whenever I see table beer, it's the one I go to. I mean, I very weirdly, the first time I tried it was, I think someone had invited us to go and try some pizza somewhere. And they just like, oh, there's this beer. It's just obviously that brown label. So I just assumed it was one that the pizza place had brewed themselves.
Yeah, or somebody's homebrew they brought along.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, you know, this person was like, oh, I heard you like beer. Here, try this. I was like, okay, here we go. And then it was Colonel Table beer. I just cracked it open and tried it. I was like, wow, that is amazing. And that probably actually was the first time that I heard about Bermondsey Beer Mile.
Okay.
And my birthday is the end of January. So what I used to do is always do the beer mile kind of towards that payday and when people would stop doing Dry January. And I'd do the beer mile and I'd just say to people, look, I'm starting here, I'm finishing here, here are the times, come join me as and when you can.
Okay.
So that was always a really fun experience. And yeah, the Colonel was always here. I mean, obviously there was a a period of time when they'd stopped.
Yeah.
But you know, it's great to see that they're back open there now.
Yeah, and also not just back open, but with a fairly large space.
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot bigger than before.
Yeah, and certainly when you look at some of the other places. So what you're saying about we start here and whatever, what do you consider, because this is an interesting question, what do you consider the start of the beer mile to be?
See, now, I always used to start at Four Pure.
Yeah.
Because it was the furthest one away.
Yeah, exactly.
And I always thought if you did it the other way around, you'd just never get there. And I always liked to end kind of towards where the food market was, because you get to that point where you need food. So it always seemed to me to make sense to do it that way around.
Yeah. Now, I agree. A lot of people saying about, you know, Southwark Brewing being the first, like the start of it. And I get that point. And also, I suppose if you start at Four Pure and work back that way, depending on how long it takes you, Southwark might actually be closed by then, you know, because they're one of the earlier closes. But for me, I think, it's working your way back to London Bridge for me. Not sort of like getting into London Bridge and then going, because, some of the better breweries are in that middle section.
Definitely, you don't want to miss them as well. And I always felt like it's going back to humanity as well. And the last thing I think I'd want is to come out of that Four Pure kind of area, having had a few drinks and then being like, where am I? How do I get back?
Well, you're on an industrial estate.
Exactly.
Let's be honest. Totally agree. Okay, fantastic. Well, I'm a big fan of the Bermondsey Beer Mile myself. I was actually born and brought up not too far away from there anyway.
Amazing.
So it kind of feels like home to me. And
Obviously
with all the awesome beer, you know, what a great home.
Yeah. Well, it's all about the Black Horse Beer Mile now as well. That's
that's
got itself involved.
Yeah. And actually that is actually more like a mile, because as much as I love the Bermondsey Beer Mile, if you started at Four Pure and ended at Southwark and pretty much walked the whole way around, you're actually walking closer to 2 miles.
Yeah.
Whereas the Black Horse one is a lot more compact, less places, obviously, but that's no bad thing.
For me, it makes it more doable.
Yeah. I mean, if you actually went, and I've done this before with a friend from up north, and, you know, we all know that they can handle their beer a lot more than us Southerners can. And, you know, this guy wanted like a pint at each place. And I'm like, whoa, hang on. There's too many for that. Way too many. Even at a half, just one half at every place, it's still a struggle, because there's just so much on offer. But the Black Horse Beer Mile is definitely more doable. But I'm hearing so many other places now that are starting to get, you know, 4 or 5 places within a small area, and they call it the whatever beer mile, and it's just, you know, the Bermondsey Beer Mile has coined that phrase and everybody wants to get in on it.
I love it as well, because, you know, especially what's happening right now within beer and how hard it is for breweries to get people in, it's great to have, you know, obviously I work in marketing, so for me to see this, it's great to see breweries coming together. And, you know, I mean, technically they're all in competition with each other, right? You know, they're all competing for people's attention. Mm-hmm. And here we are, you know, they're kind of getting together and have created this Black Horse Beer Mile to ensure, you know, they can put themselves on the map and get people along and trying their beer. So it's for me, it's a great thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's almost basically, as you say, it is that they're all in competition, but as we know, with all of the collaborations that go on in the craft beer world, that craft beer, you know, craft breweries don't tend to feel that, competitive nature. But also, I guess when you've got several places near you, it does attract in the crowd. If you're in the middle of nowhere on your own, or with maybe one other place, you may not get as much of a crowd. But when you've got people coming for, as you say, with the Black Horse Mile, if you've got people coming in for wild card, then, you know, they're gonna experience the other breweries and vice versa. So at least there's a reason for a larger crowd to come in and experience all, I think it's about 7 or so on the Black Horse Mile at the moment. Yep. So I'm all for those kind of things.
Yeah, definitely.
Around the country, well, you know, beer miles galore. That's good for
me. Well, imagine the Otley Run is probably one of the first. I know that's more pubs, but that's probably one of the first kind of big pub crawls that I ever came across when my sister went to Leeds. And I went to Swansea Uni, and they had the Swansea Beer Mile as well, which by the time I went to uni, never really existed. But that was a number of pubs, again, that kind of tried to, I think for a student town, try to get people to visit all the pubs.
Excellent, excellent. Right, okay. Well, Tom, it's been excellent chatting with you tonight. Thanks very much for coming on to the podcast. And let's go back over the details of this year's festivals again. So starting off on 9th and 10th of June, Bristol at Harbourside. Then moving on in July 21st and 22nd at the Depot Mayfield, Manchester. And then rounding off with that massive sounding one, Tobacco Dock, 11th, 12th of August for, of course, the London Craft Beer Festival. So good luck with everything. I hope it all goes well. I'm sure they will. And people listening that want to go down to any of those or all of those, get your tickets now, and then you can see who's pouring later.
Yeah, amazing point. Yeah, I look forward to seeing you at the festivals as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, thanks very much, Tom.
Cheers.
If you fancy attending any of those great sounding beer festivals, head over to wearebeer.com or each festival's individual website. Just Google London, Bristol, or Manchester, along with the words Craft Beer Festival, and I'm pretty sure you'll find them. I'll include the links in the show notes too. So head over there and book your tickets. You can be safe in the knowledge that there will be an incredible range of breweries pouring at each one. Sadly, I've looked at those dates and I actually already have plans on each and every date. So I won't be able to attend any myself. But if they do hold a Christmas one in London again, I'll definitely head to that. And I'll also try and keep the dates free for next year. So thanks so much for listening. Join me in 2 weeks' time, where my guests will be Sarah Sinclair and Vinnie Rosario from Leith's Moonwake Beer. Cheers.